Finishing or you know, cresting a month of talking about the sitting meditation practice itself, and really just a couple points to sort of tie in and to bring in some of what this tone that I brought into the meditation. Last week we talked about, or over the last couple weeks we talked about how this process of trying to settle the mind in one area or activity or object, and how that gets interrupted by activation, essentially, the nervous system erupting with a little ping of worry or fear or frustration or shutdown, and then the emotion and story that comes with that being what happens when the mind gets distracted and then needs to come back, especially when the distraction is long-held repetitive things, with which it often is. And so what happens if we think about all of that as grasping? That when, you know, story and feeling connected with the what we call the hindrance of sensual pleasure, grasping at sensual pleasures, grasping at essentially more comfort than I have presently, right? Coming through the senses, the five physical senses. That one's clearly grasping, but its opposite, right? Aversion, pushing away the painful or the unpleasant, is thought of also as a subset of grasping, you know, essentially wanting to not have something that I have, right? Wishing that the pain would go away is a kind of grasping for the state of non-pain, non-discomfort, non-stress. The hindrance of restlessness and worry is partly energetic, like there's too much energy in the body, it's not moving in a way that's in flow. And in a way, as we drop into this felt sense of like, what am I trying to do? What is my system trying to do as with this kind of jumpy energy? There's again very often a kind of settling is uncomfortable, and so it's trying to accomplish something. There's a trying to get or do something. I'm trying to fix my posture or kind of fix the story of my life somehow. Inability to settle is a kind of grasping at like what will help me to feel safe enough to settle and land. And the perception of safety is core here, right? I think that in a certain way, the amount or the degree to which we feel safe is the degree to which we'll drop into meditative stillness. And they go absolutely in parallel. At a certain point, if I don't feel safe, I won't drop further. Because the dropping into stillness is a settling of a kind of engagement with the sensory world, it's also a settling of a kind of vigilance in relation to sensory stimulus. I have to be able to, as the early texts really describe beautifully, let go of engaging with my senses for a little while. And the only way I can do that is so I feel safe. Right? Otherwise, I have to keep my eyes open, my ears open, my psychic antenna open for threat. I think this is why the core foundational practice is the practice of refuge, that we go for refuge again and again, because as we practice, the truth of profound uncertainty or lack of safety ultimately becomes more and more apparent, right? Everything changes. Everything is lost. The recollections remind us of this. They say, you know, I'm going to age. I'm going to get sick. I'm going to die. Everything I love will be lost. And the only thing that I own is the thread of my karma, my actions and their results. And this is an intensely sobering reflection. And so it says that, all of those things you grasp at are not going to provide ultimate security. Therefore, refuge. You go for refuge as a way to say, there is something to rely on. And not because it's permanent, like the Dharma isn't permanent, right? The Buddha's teachings can be forgotten. And mythically speaking, they have been forgotten many times and rediscovered. That's embedded in the early stories, is that the Buddha is not a unique being, but is simply one being in an infinite stream of beings who realize this thing over and over and then teach. And at a certain point, conditions, entropy succeeds, and the Dharma will disappear from the world. The teachings of liberation will disappear. And there's a whole period where they're gone, right? Because the thing that they are is not an abstract truth, but it's an embodied sequence of experiences. And one of the texts says, as soon as there's a generation where nobody respects concentration, the Dharma begins to disappear from the earth. Because without concentration, the profound states of ease and settledness and then liberation can't be attained. And so, and when liberation is not attained, no one can teach it. And once no one teaches it, the Dharma becomes watered down, and the texts say, in the end, all that will be left is empty ritual and a few surface-level things that people are doing that are kind of beliefs, doctrines, but no actual realization. So the Dharma itself is impermanent. And so even the teachings on refuge are not a refuge, haha, but taking refuge is still the clearest thing we can do in a world where everything is like that. We take refuge and then we practice ferociously in a way, which doesn't mean like, you know, in an unhealthy way. It just means that once you see that everything is a kind of grasping, and then you let it go, and there's this open space, and there's a settling, and the settling settles more and more and more and more the more that you let go of. Once you really get that, that's the beginning of it being over for you. Meaning, the part in you that continues to grasp at existence, the part in the human realm that continues to grasp at existence, fades from your karmic stream. The first moment of really getting that is called stream entry in this tradition. And stream entry isn't full liberation. You still have lots of work to do, but it guarantees your liberation within a finite amount of time. 7 lifetimes, if you want to get specific on the literal doctrine of rebirth, but you can just think of it as like within a finite amount of time, within a known amount of time is a better way to say it. All time is finite. Within a known amount of time, liberation will be attained. And I think that's because the main thing that you see with stream entry is that the process of endlessly grasping is futile. And seeing that is not different from seeing that the self that you identify with was only sustained as a narrative through repeated acts of grasping. That makes sense? The self is sustained as a story through repeated tiny moments of grasping. Right? In other words, in this very moment, the way that I know that I am me is that a story comes up that says, the perception I'm having right now is similar enough to one I remember having a while back that I'm gonna own it. And I'm gonna make a connection between those two perceptions. Yeah? So that's a narrative leap that we call identity. And it's the way that continuity is perceived. Right? I feel similar enough today as to how I did yesterday, therefore I decide it's the same person. And conventionally we agree it's the same person, which means it's the same person. Stream entry challenges that perception by noticing that to make that connection is itself to grasp at something. Is it itself to say that the perception of a consistent self feels like security to me, and that to not have that would feel unsafe or insecure, therefore I grab at it. And it is a security in many relative ways. For most of us, healing from layer upon layer of trauma, individual, familial, cultural, ecosystem level trauma, identity is, it is our most profound kind of certainty. And it is that until it's not. And for most of the path, it is that. And so none of this says that you don't exist or that that thing is wrong. It simply says that it's something that can be seen through with training. I remember when I was a child, the perception that there was a kind of boundary around my house that was like a couple hundred yards, a couple blocks of my little suburban tract. And I remember the feeling of everything within that boundary being familiar and therefore being kind of safe. And everything outside that boundary, which was strangely marked by a house that had these funny colored rocks out front, as being like the mysterious place out there. And I remember the first time I crossed that line alone, and I was out in front of that house that had the funny colored rocks, and I felt so weird in my whole being that I was like out in the unfamiliar part, right? I had crossed a boundary in my felt sense of identity that was interwoven with safety and familiarity, right? This was my place. This is how far I had ever gone. Everything past that was weird. And I remember the feeling 10 years later of realizing that, being a teenager, biking past it and being like, oh my God, this was just the other side of my little enclosed, all houses identical tract. In other words, it was absolutely not anything different than what was on the other side of that line, but that was my childhood perception. So I outgrew that, and then that limitation, the sense of my identity as being bounded by that spatial field, and what it felt like to cross it, all of that is so gone now. I've just vastly outgrown it. Now I only feel that, you know, I have to go to like, I don't know, the other side of the world and be dropped into a town that I've never been in before and have no map and no connections and nobody I know and really look around and be like, whoa, where am I? I have to go that far to have that feeling now. And again, the same thing has happened. I've crossed a boundary in my sense of identity. And then I feel that vibration. So, what if everything that we grasp, what's the best way to say this? Grasping is the only thing that keeps us from settling into profound stillness. Settling into stillness is the pathway toward liberation because we're stilling the grasping process. Those two things are the same. Stop grasping, get liberated. Grasping keeps you from being liberated. This is really a teaching on the Four Noble Truths, right? The second noble truth of grasping. If that's a way to think about the process of spiritual practice, that it's this subtractive process of constantly seeing the places where I'm hooked and letting go and dropping a layer, seeing where I get hooked in that layer, letting go, dropping. Now we have to pause and say, what does letting go mean? My teacher Eugene Cash at one point said, I never let go of a single thing in my life. Very realized Buddhist teacher said, I never let go of a single thing. And what he meant, of course, in his kind of Zen humor kind of way, was that letting go isn't volitional. This is what I got from it, and I think this is true. You don't let go of things on purpose. In the same way that when you want to forgive somebody for having hurt you, you can try to forgive them, and you could even do the relational repair of saying that you forgive them, but actual forgiveness doesn't necessarily happen when you say it, or you think it, or you want it. It happens when it happens. In the same way that my crossing that boundary as a child into the unfamiliar further reaches of the suburbs did not in and of itself end the perception of that that smaller identity. But crossing it many times eventually did. But it wasn't volitional. It wasn't on purpose. I didn't immediately say, now I will feel at home on the other side of the tract. One day I just forgot that I didn't feel at home there. Right? It just changed on its own. And in the same way, everything I've ever let go of, right? I never decided to stop thinking about a former lover or stop watching that TV show. Or maybe I decided to stop watching it, but I never decided to stop thinking about it. Or even if I decided to stop thinking about it, that didn't work. I thought about it as long as I thought about it. You think about the former lover as long as you think about them. And at some point, if you have stopped thinking about them, you didn't do that on purpose. Your karma rolled on to the point where that was the result. And that's letting go. So letting go is not on purpose, but all of the actions of practice that we do on purpose, if we do them skillfully, conduce toward letting go. So the month is about talking about the meditation practice itself. One way to think about meditation practice is that taking, of all the many things I could do where I have a kind of flow state in my mind, where I'm concentrating, where I'm doing one thing, one of the things that distinguishes what we call meditation is that we're doing it in stillness, and we're not engaging with external sensory objects. So then, let's talk about stillness for a minute. I come to sit, I settle the body in stillness, and I take this posture. Most of the postural guidelines are to put me in a position where there's the most possibility for a free and unbound flow of energy. So I don't want to be slumping or straining, but I want to be in a way that I can feel most vibrant and easeful. And then I really want to relax, right? I want to be as unconstricted as possible within that. Both of those are not just because those are wonderful in and of themselves. Like, it's not just that it's great to feel comfortable, although it is, but because comfortable is the only way we can deepen in stillness, and stillness is the point. So, and not absolute stillness, right? We know that the heart keeps beating, the breath keeps going. There's no stillness. But the process of letting go of physical movement and coming into physical stillness is the most surface layer of the entire process, right? Another layer down, let's call it like the emotional layer. Emotions are like erupting sensations connected with a story that has charge in my life. So I bring the body into some stillness, and often like my mood, my emotional field comes into view. Like, oh, you know, I'm so grumpy. Or maybe just an energetic kind of mood comes into view. Oh my God, I'm so exhausted. And so then to process that is to recognize its charge and its movement. How do you bring that to stillness? You know, it's like, oh, how do I work with the energy of restlessness or tiredness? How do I work with the emotions of grasping or fearing or pushing away or anger or freeze? And what I do is again, like, in the same way that to bring the body into stillness, I have to feel its aches and its pains, and I have to kind of rock back and forth and find the center of gravity and find a balanced position and then relax into it and then wait for kind of the energies to settle. I can't just be like, be comfortable and alert, and like instantly I am. It's like, oh, yeah, right, okay, It's like all this little kind of process. It's the same with feelings, right? I'm a little grumpy, and I'm like, and the story comes through, and I feel some ache, and then I kind of relax into it, and it settles, and then And I do really exactly the same thing. And at some point, the emotional field, right, through non-engagement, settles. In the same way that the movement field, through non-engagement, settles. If I keep sort of doing stuff, the movement field never settles. So I just have to settle it. And then I deal with the different little kind of rumblings and risings of it until it calms. Same thing with the emotional layer. And the same thing with the mental layer, the mind layer of stories and thoughts and images that stream through that, again, are out of my conscious control unless I use strong will. We talked about last week the five ways to stop distracting thoughts, and the most serious of them, right, is, you know, that the meditator, you know, like, make a fist, clench your teeth, tongue in the roof of the mouth, bear down, and crush mind with mind, was the phrase from the early text. It's crazy. But necessary sometimes, right, when disciplining toddlers, occasionally, a strong boundary. And the mind is essentially a toddler, as far as I can tell, for most of us. So, the same thing. What does letting go mean? You know, come into relationship, make some space, relax, understand, wait. Repeat. So if this is a model that makes sense for practice, this kind of subtractive model, then we get to bring in to close here, and a good word to close the year with. This word that I talk about a lot, but isn't the most popular word in Western Buddhism, which is renunciation. Not the most popular in Western yoga either. It sounds like I'm disciplining myself to not have something that I want. Renunciation is like, I will not have the chocolate. I will not have, you know, I will not flirt with the wrong people. But what it is a word speaking about the process of letting go. And it hinges on two things. One is the perception of wholesomeness and unwholesomeness that we talk about a lot. So renunciation is the practice of being committed to the wholesome, right? Being committed to goodness, basically. And so, for instance, committed to the wholesome, let's take my two examples, right? Should I eat the chocolate or should I not eat it? Should I flirt with this person or not flirt with them? Both are kind of pleasurable in the sensual realm, the sensory realm. But they have different relationships to wholesome and unwholesome, right? Having the chocolate may or may not be wholesome, kind of depending on my physiology and my eating habits and all of that, and my belief systems, right? Is it candy or is it a superfood, right? The Thai monks can eat chocolate after noon, which is the cutoff for eating food, because when chocolate was first imported to Thailand, it was imported as a medicine. And so it was given the category of medicine within the monastic structure, and it persists as that. So I know Thai monks who, you know, who are popping dark chocolate all afternoon, because it's one of the foods they can eat. Only dark, not milk, because milk is nutrition. Uh-huh. So, sugar, but also, by the way, is a medicine, it's not considered food. Which it's not. So they can also eat sugared candy, and do. So calling something wholesome or unwholesome like that, where it only affects me, it may or may not be depending on my conditions. When it's relational, like who to flirt with, then we're really in the realm of the ethical teachings. And there, renunciation really is the willingness to renounce acting on an impulse towards sensual pleasure when I could perceive that impulse is based in a grasping, and my ethical principles, my sila, kicks in and says, is this going to cause harm? And if there's any perception that it could cause harm, then renunciation is the willingness to not do that. Right? So it's based in the perception of what keeps me on the path, and that's grounded ultimately in ethics as the basic kind of barometer. So then renunciation can be thought of as the entire path, as the motor for the entire path. But the whole journey from confusion to clarity, or from bondage to liberation, to use the ancient metaphor, is not one of attaining something that you don't have. That's like somehow deep in the future. Like I want to get something that I don't have. It's not a kind of education. It's not like I want to learn more about such and such, so I'm going to go to grad school and learn about it and attain that information. That would be an additive process. It's a subtractive process. It's just take away everything that keeps you bound until you are free of limitations. And that freedom of limitations, and this is particular to the more classical yoga systems, they say results essentially in a profound stillness. That when the nervous system or the energetic being no longer needs to get anything, no longer needs anything to be different than it is in any way, the natural result of that is stillness. So in meditation, that would be samadhi. That would be the deeply settled heart and mind. As soon as you don't grasp completely, well, there's nothing else to do, is there? Because that's all that doing is, in a certain way. Right, which is not entirely true. It is entirely true. It's not that that's always unwholesome. So not being monastics, there are types of grasping that are wholesome for lay people to do, right? Like making money to support monastics was the ancient most wholesome thing for lay people to do. But also like taking care of our families, you know. You're not allowed to become a monk if you're deeply in debt or you have people that are your dependents who need you to take care of them, like, right? Because that would be actually to cause harm. So you have to be free of debt. You have to say that you're free of debt. They were smart, those monks. Right. Otherwise, you'd have the monasteries just full of people running away from the law, mm-hmm. essentially. So there are types of grasping, meaning types of engagement that, of course, are deeply valuable, necessary to do. And then the encouragement becomes, can we do those, but stay within the stream of letting go? How do you engage with others in a relational way, in a political way, in a social or communal way, without taking your eyes off the prize, which is, how can we create the conditions that more and more people feel safe enough to let go, to stop grasping at consuming more things, getting more embedded in strain and stress. I'll close out the year by saying that I think that the more people that let go in this way, the less of a support resource-intensive capitalism has to thrive, because of course if you don't need much, they don't own you, and if they don't own you, you're a little bit freer, and if they didn't own, you know, several billion of us, the whole system would look different right now. So just a little footnote toward that. Smashing capitalism, etc. But we'll end the year with this. The whole path is letting go. So, thoughts and feelings here. So we open into this discussion. Just to hear some voices, and really any way that this kind of flowers into your reflections about your own practice or this world as we close out our year. Yeah, Natalia.
Thank you, Sean.
Yeah.
While you were talking about letting go, I was reflecting on my own experience. I heard somewhere that when we grow, we're not doing things better. Oh, no, wait, hold on a second. It's like when you're letting go or you're changing, you're not doing things better. You think you do them differently, meaning you're growing. And kind of struck me, I heard it 2 days ago, literally. And I think it's so relevant to what you're talking about today, because I'm looking at some of my behaviors and habits just a few years ago, before I kind of became mindful of what's happening around me. And it just strikes me, it's like, I could have done things better, but I would have had the same result.
Mm.
It's kind of, I need to outgrow myself, or, as you say, let go of certain things and get grounded for change to happen.
Yeah.
I don't know if my karma left me. You said
I think so.
Seven lives, right? But yeah, I think that I can relate to that. And like, I was trying so hard to make things better.
Yeah.
But now you see, it doesn't do it. It's not the answer, basically. You just need to grow and let it go.
Right.
And it just, things will just fall into places naturally. Just been my experience.
It's such a mystery, right? Like it's absolutely what there's some way that, you know, the path seems so mystical and mysterious, and you could reframe the whole thing into like grow up, right? Like we're just growing up, right? Letting go of things that no longer serve us, doing things differently. Part of the mystery of growing up in this way is that, like, yeah, trying and trying to make things better isn't actually the thing that makes them better. Growing up and maturing is the thing that makes them better. But if you hadn't been trying, you also wouldn't have been growing up as quickly, because the trying and the growing up are interwoven somehow, right? If you had still been a person who wasn't even trying, that's also a person who hasn't grown up as much. And so they come together. And it's still true exactly where you're, you know, what you're saying, that like it happens when it happens, or it happens as it happens, is the maturing and the growing up process unfolds. I like the sense in what you're saying, that, you know, we can take some of the self-blame out of it. Like, oh, I was doing it wrong, or I wasn't doing enough. And both of those are, they can't be true, they're just stories. It can be true that, I mean, it's always true that, like, what I was doing had its results. That's the only thing. So then here you are.
It kind of helped me. Actually, it helped me a lot when you mentioned the kind of technique to utilize to take feeling of guilt and blame out of myself. When you suggested for me to relate that experience as unskillful.
Yeah.
It took so much pressure away. It's like, well, it was just unskillful.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of me beating up myself, I was thinking, oh, so I was not like a bad person. I just didn't know any better.
Yep.
It was unskillful.
Yeah.
And it kind of took the pressure away.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
You're welcome. It's absolutely true. Yeah, it's part of what I love about this system. There's no sin in this system. It's just skillful and unskillful action. Thoughts here.
Yeah, well, you're making me think of that quote, it takes as long as it takes, right?
Yeah.
And somehow today was a twisted mess of misery and confusion.
Somehow. Right?
And I was just trying to be so, just trying to, okay, so what would be skillful now?
Mm-hmm.
And coming up with nothing. And
I so know where that happens. I'm like, okay, I can see that I'm a mess. And I can ask myself, like, okay, what would be the skillful response? And because of the state I'm in, you know, the answer is like, I don't know. I can't really. I can't tell, because you know?
Had been talking about at one point. You were talking about the state that you were in at home, and that Sarah said you're confused.
Yeah.
Do you remember telling about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was thinking about that, yeah. And I was also thinking, well, it's not necessarily the best thing to just sit and focus on the breath. So I went to a movie.
Great.
And. But it was just so, such a mess, and just, I knew I should come here, you know, and when, just the beginning of the guidance about grasping and letting go, and okay, thank you.
It's amazing that, you know, it's not like you don't know that.
I know,
but we have to be reminded over and over. How many times have I just like gone to a sitting and I'm just like, rah, 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 and some teacher's like, hey, it's all about letting go. And I'm just like, oh, you got me again. You know, I've only been doing this, like coming for 20 years. And you're just like, oh, let go. And you go, all right, I was grasping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a little discouraging, really.
Sorry.
It's true.
No, but you know, it's like that. I mean, the, you know, stream entry begins with, like, little bits of letting go, right? Like, you know, admitting that you know, like, superstitious ritual doesn't actually work is part of stream entry, right? And then more deeply, like, getting a hit of, like, oh, this is really true, this thing, right? But then, like, the process goes on for a very long time, and full liberation... The hinge to full liberation is these really deep letting goes, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, it's not an all or nothing process. You have like these little moments of like, oh.
Yeah, but there's also this thought of like tonight and me. Okay. It's all about letting go. But you can't create a formula for tomorrow night.
You can't, no. well, because you don't know what you'll have to let go of.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of confusion I'll be in tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like
I mean,
you said words today.
totally. I mean, this is the thing. It's not a... If it was a mechanistic practice, then in a certain way it would be easier, but it also wouldn't really be transformative, I think. It would become this kind of rote thing.
Yeah.
There's no way to mechanize, like, letting go, renunciation. Because you have to actually because karma is very complex. You have to go through the process.
Yeah.
So here I am hanging out, and then like I think everything's just fine, and then boom, I get socked with this idea or that thing, and I have to deal with it, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, I'm cruising along, you know, really great, and then you know, I get a text, and it's like your dad had a stroke, and I'm like, shit, you know, and it's like deal with the next turning of the wheel.
It's a purification. Yeah. There's more stuff coming up that then...
Totally. You could, and that's you know, really an ancient metaphor for this. And again, the purification idea is part of this sort of subtractive, you know, sense of like, oh, here's a layer of clinging to how people see me. And I have to process that whole sort of realm of karma, really. Like, oh, I want to be seen in a certain way. And then, like, at some other point in practice, and it's not linear, at some other point in my practice, I'm like... Oh, here's the part where I have to process like never quite feeling like I belong or, you know, feeling like I have to be right all the time or, you know, feeling like everyone secretly hates me. Like whatever it is, whatever your thing is, at some point you hit that layer and you're just like, oh, this is it. Now I have to be with this. Yeah. And you do this whole process with that thing until it lets go. Mm-hmm. And it takes as long as it takes. And that thing is gone, and you're like, whew, I never again, you know. Sometimes you know when you're done with a certain thing. Maybe it loops back, but, you know, or it changed form. But I think that the layers of enlightenment, they call them, or like the really these markers of profound completion are these moments where you actually know that a given thing, you're done with it, right? Like, oh, you're just never again going to believe in that exact story.
Yeah.
And like... And the feeling, the knowing, because the liberation moment in in the early tradition is described as a moment, the recognition of that moment having happened, and then an understanding of what it means, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, that happened. Wow. Mm-hmm. You know? And it's just like, oh, right. Like, there's the feeling of being done with something, like,
yeah.
And then there's noticing that it happened. Oh, that just happened. Wow, I'm really done with that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this kind of cognitive, reflective sort of harvesting of that insight, basically.
Yeah.
And then you've got it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that just seems to happen like kind of fractal-like.
Yeah.
Down through the whole thing, right? Yeah. Anything else before we? Actually, we have time, but other thoughts. Yeah. Hi.
I wanted to thank you for beautiful journey.
Oh, thank you so much.
Quite a journey for sharing organic intelligence.
Yeah.
That has been really complemented along with the teachings.
Yeah.
And it's pretty enlightening to realize that additional layer tonight with the story that we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
Your childhood memory and your perception transitioning. And realizing that when you forgive somebody, it's not necessarily innate in us, that it's going to happen involuntarily.
Yeah.
It's another layer for me. And it's
very
much complementing the element of how we can feel the energy within us and how we can carry ourselves, because it's more teaching. It seems to be really a journey. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for saying it. Totally. It's great to have you here for all this time. Pleasure. Yeah.
Can you say something about where the forms of meditation, like a walking meditation, that actually involve literal, not stillness?
Yeah.
Where is the? I mean, I can actually get into a pretty deep meditative place sometimes in a walking meditation, or in that Korean thing. Have you ever done that? Where there's just like,
no.
Do you know this?
No.
Oh, I'll look it up. But it's really
cool.
It's like a hand gesture, and you keep repeating the thing, and it has a form, but you get into sort of a trance-like state with it.
Cool.
In a good way. But it's not still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's lots of meditative things that aren't stillness.
Whirling dervishes and
totally.
Lots of things.
It's clear that certain kinds of rhythmic, repetitive movement are a really nice platform for the mind to get really still. And so. I would make a distinction then between traditions that emphasize the movement forms over the stillness forms, and sort of where a given tradition's emphasis is on the spectrum of forms between stillness and movement, and then I'd be curious about those traditions. I'm going to propose that the traditions whose primary forms are further along the spectrum toward movement than stillness are also going to have a doctrine of liberation that is more inclusive of engagement over renunciation. In other words, you're going to get more devotional or tantric or non-dual teachings, I think, in traditions whose primary forms aren't as still. So you can definitely enter really beautiful meditative states doing, you know, non-stillness based practice. So many beautiful non-stillness based practices. And I think that the stillness of sitting meditation is particularly conducive to the kind of cessation of grasping that's at the heart of the early tradition, the early Buddhist tradition, the Theravada tradition. And that the more movement-based forms are going to give rise to stillness of, in some ways, perhaps the energetic or mental faculties in different ways, but that then might parallel ideas of liberation that are phrased more, let's say, in relation to fullness rather than emptiness, or letting go into the flow of all things rather than stopping engagement with the flow of all things. And then it's a side note to actually ask, and it's an impossible thing to study, therefore it's a nice thing to talk about late at night, which is it's a side note to ask whether the culmination of those various paths is how similar or different mm-hmm. those culminations are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm actually going to propose something that's not the common viewpoint, which is that those culminations are actually different.
Mm.
There are different enlightenments. A way of saying, like, truth is one, expression is many. And that there's expressions of liberation that are just as liberated, but that have different personalities, different energetic profiles.
And can you have more than one? Can you?
It seems like really profoundly talented practitioners can touch into the truth behind many different traditions and get it, and manifest different types of fruition.
Different flavors.
But but folks seem to, I don't know anyone who has remained in a, what to say, in a non aligned way in relation to them. I only know of teachers who acknowledge the rightness of many traditions and many different types of enlightenment, but have one that they take their stand in. The ecstatic Indian saint Ramakrishna in the mid 19th century, the teacher of the monk who became Swami Vivekananda, Ramakrishna was a Kali devotee in Calcutta who had ecstatic visions of the goddess Kali as the benevolent mother archetype, not in her destroyer archetype, but in a kind of bright archetype, and he was a deep kind of trance mystic. Basically, he would go into these long trances and move and do different things. And at one point in his practice, he wanted to discover whether some of the other traditions were valid, and he did Muslim practice for a couple of weeks, doing the five times a day prayer and orienting toward and saying the mantra, Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet. And he did it for a couple of weeks, and he said, oh yeah, this tradition is true. By which, coming through his lineage, what he meant is he did it, he had a vision, he encountered the reality of that thing, and then he let it go. He was like, yeah, that's true. Those guys, that's a fine tradition. And he did several of these. He did some Jesus Christ practice, he did some Hindu practice, he did some Buddhist practice. He was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, all you guys, you're all right. So there are some people who can do that.
What was his name?
Ramakrishna.
Oh.
Yeah, if you want to read a really gorgeous, inspiring book about him, there's a book called Great Swan, which is the English transliteration of his kind of title, Paramahansa. I'll finish with this. Here's essentially the way that I understand the relationship between the cessation and engagement traditions. And this is a really, I don't talk about this much. This is a description of kind of the absolute layer of things. When all involuntary grasping is released, there seems to remain a thread of volition or choice where one can make a choice at the very end of practice, at the very end of grasping, when there is no more constriction in the heart at all. It appears that there is a choice point between cessation and engagement. And that when cessation is what's chosen, that's what's called Buddha or Arahant, right? Nirvana, the end the end of all bondage based in the fuel of grasping. And if engagement is chosen, that's the path we could call bodhisattva, that is essentially just as enlightened, but has chosen to remain, which doesn't mean remain in a kind of dualistic way. It simply means there's no limitation and engagement is being chosen. And the only thing that would inspire engagement at that point, because there's no grasping to inspire action, the only thing left would be compassion for others to inspire engagement. So that's why compassion is the singular quality of bodhisattvas. It's the only thing they have that ties them to the world, because all other grasping has been released. So then if we think about this in a radically non-dual way, we can think of the universe as energy that is choosing to stay engaged and energy that is choosing to be released. And that's all that's happening. And then within the further engagement, there's a spectrum from liberation to confusion, and we're all on it somewhere. So we're all in the column of bodhisattva action. And as we purify the layers, we get closer and closer to full release and the actual choice point. You don't have a choice to become a Buddha until you do. And there's a beautiful story of the great Thai Lao forest teacher Ajahn Mun, my great-grandfather teacher, who revitalized kind of the forest tradition in Thailand in the early 20th century. And he actually wrote about the moment of choosing cessation, choosing to become an arahant rather than a bodhisattva. And realizing that, like, it wasn't about like one being better than the other or anything like that at all. What his student wrote in the text was simply that he realized that the world needed more arahants. The world actually just needed people to choose that and to show that it was possible to be that released. And he said as soon as he reflected in that way, that thought arose in him that it was the right thing to do to choose cessation, he said it was as if the last like kind of pillar in his heart broke open and he just began to weep and his path was over. And then he wandered around teaching for, you know, a long time, as the Buddha also did. He taught deities and spirits in caves, and he's a very mysterious teacher. But that was his choice point, was actually, like, really? Cessation? Like, everything else was gone. And he said yes to it. And then for me to say more about what that means is beyond me. So that's a good place to stop for the...
Beyond your pay grade.
You know, it's really beyond my pay grade. Yeah, truly. But it's great. We got to absolute liberation in the last moment of the year. I will be here next week, January 2nd, and then I'll be gone on the 9th, and we'll have a wonderful sub. It might be Don Scott. I can't remember. But and I'll be back after that. So blessings. Some of us will be on retreat the 3rd to the 10th. If you still want to come, there's still space. And whatever the new year means to you, may it be safe and filled with joy and blessing. So thanks for being here. Yeah. So to close, actually, let me just chant the. I'm going to chant the closing dedication of merit chants. If you want to chant along or follow along, they're on the back. of the chant sheet. It's just a moment of closing, to close the year out. Sending blessings out to everyone everywhere, and to offer the merit of our practice for the well-being of all. Let's sing the Pali. Sambe sata sada hontu avera sukha jivino kataham punya palam mayam sabe bhagi bhavantu te hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha buddhanu bhavena soti hontu nirantaram hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha dhammanu bhavena soti hontu nirantaram hotu sabang sumangalam rakantu sabha devata sabha sanghanu bhavena soti hontu nirantaram. May all beings be free. May our merit be a gift of well-being to all. May there be every good blessing. May the devas protect you. By the power of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, may you forever be well. Happy New Year.